Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi, and it's documentary time again this week. My guest is Stephen Mitchell, who has put together a documentary about probably one of the last true Hollywood mavericks out there, Larry Cohen. Now, most of our listeners will recognize the movies It's Alive, Cue the Winged Serpent, even a Masters of Horror short by David Scow called Pick Me Up. Larry Cohen has done that and so much more over, 50, 55 years worth of just churning out content, literally. So, Steve, welcome to the show.
Oh, nice to be here.
First of all, what got your attention on Larry? Where did the inspiration to do a documentary about someone who has touched so much of Hollywood yet himself remained on the fringes?
Well, I knew Larry's work, and I knew his, I'm dating myself a little bit, but I knew his TV work as well. So I was familiar with his name. I was familiar with his credit. I think it was the second release. I was going to say reissue, but that's not actually completely accurate. The second release of It's Alive got kind of a wide release in New York City, where I grew up. And the ad campaign was very compelling. You know, the famous line, there's nothing wrong with the Davis baby except, you know, it's alive. And I saw that and I said, all right, I'm going to check this out. And I was quite taken with the movie. I thought it was really good. Personally, I kind of wish we got a few more shots of the baby, but there was a reason why Larry did that, which was he felt that if you showed the baby too much, it wouldn't be scary anymore. And so, but other than that, I thought it was really good. It had, you know, at the core of it, it had interesting ideas. So Larry was on my radar from that movie on. But the idea for the movie, my movie, King Cohen, came from the IMDb, actually. I was browsing his credits one day, and I was not amazed to see all the credits that I knew. I was amazed to see all the credits I didn't. And a picture was forming for me that this guy was extraordinarily prolific in ways that I didn't even know. So I was looking to create a project for myself. I was producing DVD special features, commentaries and stuff at the time. But I wanted to do my own film. And Larry just, it was an idea that kind of got into my head and wouldn't go away, which is always a good thing. You know, sometimes you can get an idea and then, you know, on Monday it sounds great. By Wednesday, you've forgotten it. But Larry didn't go away. Larry stuck with me. And then the trick was to try and get it financed. That was an adventure unto itself. And it took a while. The folks at Image thought it was a great idea. And they said to me, you know, this is one of my first real lessons about the business side of show business, although I was not unsavvy. They said, sounds great. Let's produce it. Maybe we'll acquire it, which is the Hollywood way of spending 10 cents on something that might have cost a dollar.
Right.
So it was a little bit of a slog getting the picture financed. I tried crowdfunding, which I was spectacularly terrible at. I think there's a whole skill set to doing crowdfunding that I was not aware of. It was like, oh, you put a few things up, you cut a trailer, you tell people they'll get Blu-rays or posters or whatever, and they'll give you all the money you need. That was not the case. Anyway, eventually I met a guy named Matt Verboys, who's the co-owner of La La Land Records, which is a movie soundtrack label, of which I was a customer. I'm a big movie music fan and collector. And we met at Comic-Con some years ago. And he said, are you the Steve Mitchell, the Cutro Chopping Mall? And I said, yes, I am. And, well, that was my passport into friendship with Matt, because he was a big, big fan. And we got to know one another again socially, and you know, we were both big movie fans, and he was an incredibly big genre fan. And one day I said, you know, I wonder if Matt might be interested in producing this, because he had indicated to me that he and his partner Michael Gerhard were thinking about doing other stuff other than the music. So I called him up and I said, let's have lunch. We go out and have lunch. You know, he says, well, maybe now's not the time financially. But I tell him I want to do this documentary about Larry Cohen. And before the N in Cohen gets out of my mouth, he says, I'm already interested. And by the time lunch was done, he said these famous words. And I talk about this a lot. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to do it. And we, you know, we raised the money piecemeal over the life of production. But we got it done. And I think we got it done fairly well. You know, I mean, the movie, I think, looks a little bit more expensive than what we, you know, than what we spent on it, which is always the one. It's one of the many goals when you make any movie. You always want to make your movie look great. And I got lucky that I had a good cameraman and lots of support. And here we are.
Well, the documentary itself looks like people, the people you were interviewing, especially Larry himself, looked like they were having fun. The scenes you shot with Michael Moriarty and Fred Williamson going, nah, Larry's recollection of that is way wrong. Let me correct the record. just the humor in those exchanges and how everyone remembers just being amazed, appalled, and amused all at the same time while making these movies, just because of how he made them. I had no idea that Q the Winged Serpent was such a guerrilla project. I never would have dawned on me. That's what that was.
Q was mostly a pretty guerrilla project. I mean, obviously they had to go into the Chrysler Building and get some level of permission. But as Larry has said, that, yeah, I only got permission to go up so many floors. He didn't get permission to go all the way up top of the spire, which, by the way, was dancing with the wind. I mean, when you're that high up in an office building, and that's one of the, I think at the time, it was the second tallest office building in New York City. The wind kind of pushes you around a little bit up there. And it, while I've never been up there, it sort of sounds akin to being seasick, being up there in the spire. But Larry, you know, Larry will always push the envelope. I mean, he is relentless. And, but still, he was running around shooting that movie mostly guerrilla style. Most of the New York movies that he made, I think until maybe The Ambulance, because he had a real legitimate budget on The Ambulance. He may have had a few more permits when he did that. But, you know, Q was still in that sweet spot of him running around the city like a madman, you know, grabbing stuff and just, you know, throwing the movie together. One of the things that Larry was famous for was his, you know, his location scouting, which was they'd drive around, he'd see a location he liked, said, stop, we're going to shoot here. And that goes to the fact that Larry's not very big on pre-production. And I actually do believe, though, that when he does have a full crew and he has production, you know, people around him, you know, the movies haven't suffered for it. I mean, I think Pick Me Up looks great, and he had a full crew on that. And then he had, I think he had a pretty full crew when he worked on The Ambulance, which was all mostly shot in New York. But that's Larry. He just runs around like a crazy guy, and he's, you know, nobody can tell him, no, you can't do that. And that's part of what makes him Larry. The other thing, getting back to the humor aspect of it, Larry kind of determined a lot of the tone of the picture when we started to interview him. He's a funny guy. I mean, I knew he would be an interesting guy. I knew he had the credentials to be a potentially interesting guy. I didn't know how funny he would be. And as we show in the movie, you know, he had originally started out as a stand-up, and he has, you know, he has the DNA and the soul of a performer. We had a screening out in Los Angeles the other night, and, you know, when Larry is in front of a crowd, you see that performer light go on within him, and he actually, to me, he looks like he gets younger when he's in front of a crowd. I mean, he really does enjoy that. So I got a sense pretty early after, I think, the first big interview that he was a funny guy. And my editor and I believed, well, whenever we can be funny, let's go with funny. And then Fred was, you know, Fred's a character. Moriarty's a character. I mean, Gaffett was very interesting, although we didn't have any, you know, he said type stuff. I tried to do that as much as possible because I thought that was just an interesting way to go. I mean, somebody mentioned, I guess, in a review of the movie that I was cross-examining Larry, you know, and you know, Moriarty and Fred Williams were like the witnesses and stuff like that, so, which I hadn't given it much thought to, but that kind of works for me. But it ultimately works for the movie, which is all that matters.
I look at those more like the elder statesmen at the corner of the bar challenging each other's big fish stories. It's like, no, the fish was like, you know, 2 feet long. No, it was 3 feet long. No, it was 5 feet long. Just trying to outdo one another because it's funny.
Well, these are alpha males, and they're pretty competitive, especially Fred. You know, Fred's one of the biggest alpha males I've ever met, and I'm kind of an alpha male myself, so I recognize one when I'm confronted by one. The other thing is that, you know, John Ford, you know, the great American director, said, you know, if you can print the truth or print the legend, print the legend. And so that was one of my guiding principles when we did King Coleman. I was sort of printing the legend. I'll let the audience make up their own mind whether or not they're all full of crap or not.
With It's Alive, because I saw that in the theaters. I think Jaws and It's Alive were my first non-children's movies that I saw in the theaters.
Those are two pretty serious non-children's movies.
Uh-huh. Yes, they are. Yes, they were. But I remember at the time wondering how the baby was made. I wasn't as curious about how the shark was made, but I was really, really curious about how the baby was made. I'm like, you can't get a baby to do that. So just learning, seeing the background stuff about Rick Baker and the makeup and, you know, his girlfriend being the baby in some of the long shots was just
fascinating
stuff. Did they keep any of those props, or are all the stuff that he was showing off at his table, were those like made by somebody else? Because I think that was also mentioned that there was somebody who was making these to sell on eBay.
Yeah. We did quite a bit of shooting with Larry at a convention in Indiana, a convention called Horror Hound. And that face from the stuff, that Garrett Morris face, I think some fan made that and brought that down and just sort of left that there for the day. But Larry has the babies. I know he's got at least one baby because I shot footage of the one baby in his house, but he has what is referred to by one of his daughters as the monster closet. And there's some pictures of him in there in the monster closet. He's got, Larry doesn't throw anything away. I'll put it to you that way. And so the baby, I know he's got, I think, two It's Alive babies. I think one has brown eyes, one has blue eyes. You know, he has props from almost everything. Some of them are not in the best of shape because the latex especially has a tendency to fall apart. But, you know, they're kind of hidden in the dark and, you know, kind of not entirely climate controlled, but mostly climate controlled. So, yeah, the props are still around all these years later.
What was something unique or interesting that you found out that you didn't previously know about any of the movies that he had made?
Oh boy, that's almost an impossible question to answer because I found out so much. I think this is not horror related, but it just went to, I think, Larry's balls. Okay, when we were cutting, my editor, I said, remember, we're dealing with his head, his heart, and his balls. And Larry had created a TV series in the 60s called Brandon, which was a pretty successful Western.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter Mirisch called him up or got in touch with him. And Walter Mirisch was one of the most powerful producers in Hollywood.
Right.
He was, essentially, if you were around and you paid attention to credits, it seemed every United Artists movie was a Mirisch Company production. Although Walter Mirisch didn't run United Artists, his product pretty much fueled United Artists, along with the Bond movies and the Pink Panther movies. So Walter Mirisch calls up Larry, and he wants Larry to write a pilot for a Magnificent Seven TV series, because the Magnificent Seven, the first one, the classic, was not a big success when it played theatrically, but when it got to television, it became incredibly popular.
Yep.
So Walter Mirisch is going, well, let me do a TV series. And Larry then tells Walter Mirisch, I don't want to do a TV series. I want to write a sequel. You should make a theatrical sequel to The Magnificent Seven, and I'll write it. And if you do it, I'll only do it if you rehire Elmer Bernstein to do the music, because Elmer Bernstein created the music for the first one, which was and still is one of the greatest scores ever written.
Yeah.
And so Larry bullied Walter Mirisch, basically, into making a sequel to The Magnificent Seven, a theatrical sequel with music by Elmer Bernstein. So that surprised me, because at the time, there were very few people more powerful than Walter Mirisch, and Larry didn't give a shit, you know. Larry wanted what Larry wanted. I thought that was fascinating. But a lot of what he talks about is fascinating.
Wow. I think that's awesome, because like Magnificent Seven is one of my favorite Westerns of all time. I had no idea Larry had that kind of chutzpah. Just like, hey, no, do this.
That kind of chutzpah? He has chutzpah by the truckload. No, Larry believes in what Larry believes in. Is a bulldog. And you know, these are all things that I kind of came to realize about who he was when making the picture. I mean, I've read a lot of it, and then I heard commentaries and stuff like that. But you don't really get to know the guy until you spend a pretty fair amount of time with the guy. And I know that when it came to just the interviews, wow, I think I had about 15 hours. And then there was just, you know, time spent with Larry when we were on the road, when we went to that convention where I was shooting all that stuff at the convention. Yeah, he just turned out to be a big surprise to me in a lot of ways.
You say you have like 15 hours or more of just interviews. How long did it take to talk to everybody to put all of this together?
Well, we cut and shot concurrently, and it just takes time to hunt and gather a lot of stuff. We were cutting things. We knew as we were cutting, we probably needed to talk to a few more people. A friend of mine, a film historian who I do commentary tracks with, Nathaniel Thompson, was what I called my secret weapon, because I knew if I had any holes in it, I could talk to Nathaniel, and Nathaniel could come in and talk very intelligently and it could be very articulate about almost anything, especially genre. So it's a continuing and continuous process when you make one of these things. I mean, it took us a long time to get Martin Scorsese. J.J. Abrams took us a long time, and he was our last get. J.J. intros the picture, and he's the teaser, I guess we could say. And ultimately, we weren't in a hurry either, I think. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, this was a portfolio piece for me and for my partners. And we had no real deadline. I mean, our investors are saying, well, what's going on? What's going on? But we felt to be in a hurry was not necessarily going to help the movie. And at the end of the day, I think that proved to be pretty true, that by taking the time, it helped us get more stuff. And there's still a few interviews I wish I could have gotten that we didn't get. But after a certain point, you just go, okay, I think I've got enough to tell the story. But it took us a couple of years to sort of, shoot it, cut it, shoot some more, cut some more, tweak it, et cetera. It took a long time. Now, my editor, because we didn't have a ton of money, was only giving me 3 days a week. Now, if I was working 5 days a week with him, we might have made the movie. You know, I think we could have made the movie in about a year. I'm not entirely sure it would have been the movie that we made, because there might have been one or two, you know, people, interesting people that we couldn't have got. But a lot of it is luck, and a lot of it is sweat.
Now, the show, the movie, I think it premiered at or played at various film festivals last year, but this right now, it's been rolling out slowly, New York, L.A., a few other cities. Mm-hmm. How has it been received? What kind of feedback have you been getting?
Well, the feedback from everybody who has seen it at festivals has been very, very positive. Everybody loves it to one degree or another. But I've heard the word love many times. So that was very gratifying. We are currently 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
Nice.
And that's extremely gratifying. I'll tell you an interesting little story. Well, it's interesting to me. I thought the movie was pretty good when we took it up to Montreal at the Fantasia. You know, I always heard stories about, you know, directors puking in, you know, flower pots and, you know, just excusing themselves so they could go run around a corner and, you know, and lose their dinner. And when we went to Montreal, I felt pretty good about it. I mean, the response to the movie had been very positive from the people who had seen it. And there we were. We're 10 minutes away from the screening, and the room was pretty full, and this was my first film festival. I'd never been to a film festival, much less have a film at a film festival. And I'm going, what if they don't like it? Because the audience determines whether or not it's any good. You can feel good about it, but what if they don't like it? And so I'm sitting actually right behind Michael Moriarty, who came from Western Canada to Montreal, and we had a nice little reunion, and Moriarty introduced Larry. It was great. I'm very fond of Moriarty. And the movie starts, and within the first couple of minutes, we're getting some laughs in what I thought were the right place. And I'm going, maybe I'm okay. And then about 20 minutes into the picture, Moriarty turns around and just says to me, he goes, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And I'm going, yeah, maybe we're okay. And at the end of the movie, we got a very nice round of applause. And I said, okay, I think we're in pretty good shape here. But you never know. No filmmaker knows. The audience will tell you. And then, strangely enough, some movies, the audience only tells you decades later. I'll give you another quick example. And since this is a horror-related interview, I'll bring Chopping Mall back. We had a 29th anniversary screening of Chopping Mall at Cinematheque here in Los Angeles. It was kind of like, I think I said to Jim Wynorski, my friend and the director, I said, yeah, it's kind of like our 29th high school reunion. And we were the cool kids, which, how weird was that? But the theater was packed, and the response was fantastic. When Jim and I made that movie back in the day, it had some theatrical. It wasn't successful theatrically, I've been told, or not terribly successful. And the movie found an audience on videotape back in the day. And so for decades, we never really knew whether or not, you know, anybody liked the movie. And ultimately, it wasn't really until decades later that we found out that the audience really, really likes the picture. We felt okay about it, but, you know, the audience never told us. Well, it was nice to get told all those years later. The audience determines everything.
Well, that's cool. The fact that the audiences let you know up front this time.
Yeah, it's nice, and it's nice that the response has been so positive, and it's great for Larry, you know, because Larry is an auteur filmmaker. The credit a Larry Cohen film means something. At the end of his films, there is always a card which says a Larry Cohen film, and that card is earned. But because Larry has been, I would say, most of his career sort of fringe. You know, he has worked in mainstream television. He's worked in mainstream features. Phone Booth, probably his most famous mainstream feature. Cellular was a big success. He wrote the story for that. But Larry was not really the guy who had big breakout movies like Spielberg or Martin Scorsese or any major Hollywood director. But yet, Larry's movies and his material has endured. So now Larry, in a sense, is getting his curtain call for his career through my film, which I, you know, you can't predict that. You don't know. But he's, you know, always been one of those guys who said, you know, if I was only maybe born back in the day, I could have worked at Warner Brothers and been like Michael Curtiz and doing, you know, movies with movie stars, because he loves old movie stars. And but now, you know, the response that he gets, and, you know, at the screenings and interviews and when he goes to conventions is, you know, how much people like his work. And, you know, Larry had said something interesting. He says, when you work in, you know, genres like horror, those movies tend to endure. You know, horror films especially endure for years and years and years after they were made. Listen, I grew up watching the old Universal horror movies, and I'm still fond of them, as creaky as they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the genre pictures don't go away, whereas mainstream pictures, I mean, my God, you know, you can go see a mainstream movie where they spent a lot of money making it, a lot of money selling it, and if it's not any good, it's forgotten within days. You make a halfway decent horror picture that finds some part of the audience, and it endures forever, or as forever as I know it, you know, my time on the planet Earth. You know?
Yeah, there are so many cheesy sci-fi and horror movies from the 70s and 80s and early 90s that nobody ever thought would do anything, but people remember them. People, you know, bought them on DVD or Blu-ray as soon as they were available, because they built up an audience. There was something appealing, something charming, something unique or ballsy about them, and they last. You know, one fan says, "Hey, have you seen this movie?" And they, you know, group of them watch them, you know, late Saturday night over a couple of beers and pizza, and it just continues on.
Oh, absolutely. My oldest friend, a guy that I met in high school in New York, lives out here in Los Angeles, and we get together a few times a month, and we watch some new stuff, and then we watch some old stuff. Some old stuff that we hadn't seen that's come out on Blu-ray that we're curious about, or then we watch old stuff that we've seen dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of times, and the stuff still works for us. I mean, it still has an appeal. I mean, my favorite movie of all time is The Thing, the original Howard Hawks produced version of The Thing. I like the Carpenter version enormously as well. But the original version of The Thing, which I think I saw for the first time when I was 7 or 8 years old on New York television, is still my favorite movie. And I've seen it hundreds of times, literally hundreds of times. And it still makes me smile when it starts. I still love the characters. I mean, I know every second of the picture. There are no surprises per se, but the revisiting of that story, which is a great story, by the way, never ceases to make me feel good or to entertain me. And The Thing is pretty high end. The thing is so good, mainstream people like The Thing. But, you know, then the flip side is there are movies, you know, other dopey movies from, you know, my youth that, you know, low budget pictures that still are, you know, speak to me in ways that, you know, I'm fond of and my friend is fond of. So it's a genre that endures. The other thing that's interesting, I was talking to a Blu-ray producer recently, and he was saying that certain genres, you can put out the very best release of a certain kind of picture, you know, and brand new transfer, great extras and everything like that, and it will die in the marketplace. But you put out a horror picture or a science fiction picture, people buy those and they want to own those. They want to be able to put their hands on them. And they want to know that that title is on the shelf ready to go at a moment's notice. And so, you know, that aspect of fandom is very potent. And, you know, Larry was lucky that he, you know, he played in that sandbox for a while because it's, you know, helped make his movies endure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Shout Factory, their limited edition special Blu-rays are amazing. The Thing and Buckaroo Banzai are my favorites so far.
Well, The Thing, the Carpenter's version of The Thing is also one of my 25 favorite movies of all time. I think it just goes to that story. I think that story, you know, the John W. Campbell story, and I've read that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's really made that version of that story. But that story, for some reason, is like one of the great movie stories. Like Jaws is one of the great stories. You know, that Scream Factory version of the Thing was great. God, it looked fantastic.
Yeah,
it looked great.
That was just delightful.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to use the word delightful with a movie with that much, you know, horror and grotesqueness and, you know, disgusting effects and all that stuff. But it's a fantastically entertaining movie. And going back to the audience, when that movie first came out, nobody went to see it. It was a flop.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge flop, and I think it scarred John Carpenter for a long time. And then it came out on home video, and it has become, you know, an evergreen title. I think it's his best picture, and I think it will be out there and be available and endure forever because the audience said, okay, we've seen it, we get it, we love it, we're going to keep watching it. Mm-hmm. And I watch that movie at least once a year. You know, that version of The Thing once again, because I think it's fantastic, and I'm a huge Kurt Russell fan.
Yes, that one definitely earned the title iconic, definitely.
I agree with you, yeah, absolutely.
Now,
do you think Larry's earned the title iconic? That's the thing.
I still think It's Alive is up there with one of those unexpected creepy ones, you know. That one, I remember that one. That one has stuck with me for decades, literally. Cue the Winged Serpent. I actually had no idea he had written Phone Booth until I saw the documentary. I'm like, wait, what's really? Cool.
Well, Larry's done an awful lot of stuff that people are not aware of, and I was able to cover a fair amount of it. But as Larry has often said to me, he said, you know, I should have made this into a mini series to really cover everything that he's done. And I said, well, I think it's better to give them enough that they want more, that they go out and find the material, than to just say, and then he did this, and then he did this, and then he did this. It's not really the movie I set out to make. The movie I set out to make was to create a portrait of a unique and idiosyncratic, original, creative artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I used the movies that I used because they told, hopefully, I was telling you, the audience, something about who he was through the movies that I used to try and create this full, you know, tapestry or portrait or one of them pretentious words about who he is. And, you know, sure, I could have done a 4-hour documentary and covered that, his theater work, because he's always giving me a hard time. And Larry gives me a hard time all the time about his theater work. Just, why don't you cover the theater work? And that's my bad Larry Cohen impersonation. And I said, well, Larry couldn't cover everything. And the other thing was that movies, you can at least go to clips or stills and illustrate your point. It's a little tough to talk about theater without having, you know, an extensive amount of at least still coverage on all of it. And, you know, he would not, but, you know, he would never accept it. Because I think Larry, like all writers in his heart, is kind of a playwright. And theater is a big deal for guys like Larry. Theater is something that, I'm not a big theater guy. I'm a movie guy. I'm a cinema guy. But for a writer, theater is more pure discipline, you know. That the writer is really the king, playwright is the king in theater. Whereas in film, that's not the case, which is one of the reasons why Larry wanted to direct, because he was tired of having other people direct his stuff. and doing it badly. And that's how he got started. And it's interesting when you look at Bowen, his first picture, Bowen is more like a play. And that movie was a surprise to me. I had not seen Bowen when we got started. And my partner Matt and I, you know, we had kind of a Larry-thon, and we tried to watch all the movies, and we hadn't seen Bowen. And I said, you know, if Bowen had been a success, Larry may have made a whole bunch of different types of movies. But then again, he might not have, because Larry was never really tied down to one genre. I think, and Loreen Landon says this, that he's a thriller writer, I think, in his heart. I think Larry always wanted to be Hitchcock. And he never quite got the chance to be Hitchcock. But let's face it, he's Larry Cohen. He's his own Larry Cohen. And you know, there's no one quite like him, which is what the whole point of the movie.
I wonder how much of his older horror stuff will turn up on the streaming services, because I know Shudder is starting to really take off. They had a really huge Joe Bob Briggs live streaming event that was so popular it crashed everything on the internet.
Wow, that I you know, it's interesting, because I was wondering, whatever happened to Joe Bob? I always liked Joe Bob. I loved Joe Bob on Turner Classic Movies when he used to be on there. So now he's with Shudder, which is great.
Yep.
Because, you know, the drive-in never dies, and neither should Joe Bob.
There you go. And I would love to have been able to see something like, you know, Q on a drive-in screen. But I missed that window.
Well, I saw Q on a New York City screen, and it's still, I mean, the drive-in experience might have enhanced Q, but Q's my favorite Larry picture, and Q just plays well anywhere. I mean, Q is just, it's just nuts. and if Larry were in the room, I would still say that. It's such a genre mashup, and it's kind of just irresistible. I mean, part of it was his finding Moriarty, played Jimmy Quinn. Part of it was just the nutty idea of a serpent flying around Manhattan, you know, the cop movie, street crime aspect of the picture. But Larry backed into a very traditional type of genre picture and told it in a very original way. He had told me, and I wanted to use this, but didn't get a chance to. He said, yeah, I'd seen all these movies back in the 50s, you know, these giant monster movies, and there was always a scientist in it with big boobs trying to convince me that she knew what she was talking about when she was talking about science and monsters and creatures and bugs, and I never believed it. And, you know, Larry's not a big fan of exposition either, and a lot of those movies were like, well, the monster is doing this because. Well, Larry hates that. Larry doesn't explain anything, and it's alive. I mean, it's there for you to sort of figure out.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really explain it. In fact, he has a scene, and we used it in the film, where Robert Emhart, who was a big character actor at the time, busy and physically kind of big, is saying, literally saying, I don't want to explain why this happened. And that's Larry. You know, Larry doesn't want to explain it. He wants you to enjoy it. He wants to get in the middle of it. You know, a lot of, you know, think of any giant monster movie from the 50s. There's always a certain amount of explanation as to how this could happen. You know, one of my favorite monster movies from the 50s is Them, and they're explaining why the giant ants in New Mexico could happen because of the atomic bomb tests, etc., etc. And there's a sequence where the scientists are explaining to all the generals and the politicians why this is happening. And it's so boring. It was maybe a little interesting the first time I saw the movie, and I love the picture. It's one of my favorite 50s science fiction monster pictures. But when it's being a detective story, you know, trying to find out where the ants are, where they've gone to, the mystery aspect is what makes that picture so good. When you're talking about the science part, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm going, yeah, okay, all right, who cares? And I'm sure Larry was, too, because Larry doesn't really explain very much the text. I mean, look at God Told Me To. Oh, my God. No pun intended. what the hell is going on with that picture? Well, Larry doesn't explain it. He just shows it. And a lot of people love that picture. The other movie that fans seem to love is The Stuff. And, you know, The Stuff shows up, and that's all we need to know. There's nobody trying to figure out, you know, what The Stuff is and what's going on and et cetera, et cetera. That's not Larry. Larry doesn't want to waste time on that. He'd rather have, you know, he'd rather create interesting characters and have them sort of propel the story, which there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, he has told me, and he's told me many anecdotes over the time that we've known each other about how he would go into meetings and everybody wants everything explained. You know, movie hasn't even been made yet. They want everything explained. He goes, you know, I don't know. It's in real life, you don't always know why things happen. But in movies, I guess that there seems to be a need for people to explain why things happen. You know, Larry's attitude, and I think he's right, is, well, here's the story, we're presenting it to you, go with it. Go with it in the context of how it's being presented. And I think that's why Larry's movies are original, because, you know, he tells his types of stories his way. And, you know, he doesn't want to be bothered with all that exposition, which, you know, that's okay. I have no problem with that.
Well, where is the movie still playing theatrically, or what's the best way for folks to see this movie and
well,
find
Well, the
Larry?
Movie opens in New York at the end of the week. We're going to be playing at the Cinema Village, which is a theater that I knew from back in the day, which is still there, which is very gratifying. Most of the theaters I went to back in the day are gone. It'll be playing in the Cinema Village starting on Friday. I think it's going to be there for a week. I think they're going to show it in the evenings. And then it's going to be playing at the Alamo Draft House in the Yonkers, I believe, on Thursday night. And the movie is kind of being, it's being distributed kind of sort of city or town or area kind of it's almost like a visiting train, you know, coming in and staying in town for a little while, and then it's going to move on. But we are going to be putting out Blu-rays, and Shudder is going to be running it after the Blu-rays come out. So, and then I think it's going to be VOD. I don't know if we're ready if it's on VOD yet, but soon. But if you're in the tri-state area of New York City, you have a chance to go see it, you know, in the course of the next week. One of my producing partners actually is going to be at the Thursday night screening at the Alamo Draft House in Yonkers. If you see him, say hello. And I don't know that we're ever going to go really completely national, but that'll sort of That'll also be determined by, you know, the demand as well. You know, people are asking about the movie, and our distributor is responding. I think we're going to be playing in Omaha, Nebraska, for crying out loud. I think that's ahead of us. I think it's going to be playing in Virginia. So, by the way, it's great to see you with an audience. That's the other thing that I discovered with this, that the audience really seems to enjoy it, and the experience of seeing it with an audience is great. I mean, I saw it with five or six festival audiences, and it's great to see it in a room with other fans. They everybody has a very, very good time, which is, again, as a filmmaker, is very gratifying.
Cool. So during the month of August, people will be able to see it in their regions, possibly, maybe. Definitely
that's
New
the
York.
That's the best I can do.
Yeah.
Okay, so New York, I know, is this weekend, this coming week. So that much I know for sure.
Okay. Well, we will put some dates up for our folks. I'll do some digging, see what we can find out. But Blu-ray later this year, perhaps?
Yes. We're working on it. And there will be hours and hours and hours of deleted scenes. I'm going to have to go through the deleted scenes and then sort of find what I think are the best and or most interesting, of which there is a lot. one of the things about making a movie like this is figuring out what you're going to use. I mean, it's, you know, you start with literally a ton of good stuff, and then you have to break it down to, you know, a 16-ounce can worth of good stuff. But that's the challenge, and that's kind of the fun, too.
I will give you a guideline. The Blu-ray of the Nightmare on Elm Street documentary, Fear Never Sleeps, was almost 4 hours long, and it aired on Netflix in its 3 hours and 57 minutes, you know, entire glory. So there's a guideline for you.
Well, you know, I told my editor, I said, you have ADD. And she said, I do not have ADD. And I said, yes, you do. I have ADD. We all have ADD because we live in the 21st century. So maybe in the old days you could say, well, it's still interesting, even though it's 3 hours worth of stuff. You have to make a movie for people with short attention spans. I mean, I think it's just the nature of our society today. We get so much thrown at us.
Yeah.
We don't know which way to look. So you want to be tight, economic, interesting at all times. Not to say that the 3 hour and 57 minute documentary isn't tight and interesting, but, you know, we did it the way we did it and tried to make the movie we tried to make, basically to be a portrait. And that's a little bit of a different thing. But I have no problem with running time. I just think people sort of get bored. Unless you happen to be very patient by nature, and I just don't think our society today, people are patient by nature.
But hey, on the Blu-ray, you can hit pause and come back later.
That's true. Listen, I do that, and I'll go look at something on my laptop for 10 minutes. So, you know, there you go.
Cool. Well, I will put up links to where they ever are available, where people can either see it on the big screen or look for it on their Shudder schedules, because a lot of people are signing up for Shudder, mostly because of Joe Bob, but hopefully Larry can bring in a few new subscribers as well.
Well, I think what's great about Shudder is it's narrow casting, but the thing is that if you like that kind of ice cream, then you're going to want to go back and you know, dip into it on a regular basis. And I think having Joe Bob on Shudder, I think is great. I love Joe Bob. He's fun.
Who doesn't love Joe Bob? All we need now is Elvira, and like the 80s horror scene will be complete.
There you go. There you go. I mean, I wonder if she's been asked or anything like that. I know she's still around.
Mm-hmm. Yep, she still appears at cons. I know that.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your time and your insights today.
Well, I hope I've been interesting.
You have. You have been.
And thank you for supporting the film and getting the word out.
The documentary is King Cohen, the true story of writer, producer, director, creator, and all-around maverick Larry Cohen. It is in theaters in New York and may soon pop up near you. We will have as many links as available for that. And we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
Welcome to Tales of the Black Badge, a Wynonna Earp fan podcast. WynonnaEarpPodcast.com. Thanks again for checking in, and I hope you all take care.
I told that devil to take you back.
Tales of the Black Badge, presented by Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV.
Hi, I'm Sendhil Ramamurthy from NBC's Reverie, and you are listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
Well, it seems like I'm going to have to sign up for a Shudder trial to see what other obscure or long forgotten classics there are that I haven't seen in 20, 30, 40 years. But I love discovering documentaries like this, especially the ones that you know are a deep dive of love. And King Cohen is actually really, really worth it, especially if you're a fan of Cohen's work and some of the actors and actresses he's worked with over the years. Just the stories of the making of some of those movies was just fascinating to learn. So what sort of obscure B-movies in the horror and sci-fi genres are your favorites that you like to keep watching over and over again, no matter how cheesy so many other people may seem to think they are? If you have a comment to weigh in on for that, the number to call is 602-635-6976, or you can send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi right here where you're listening on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play, on TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio. If you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let other people know that you're checking out the show, and maybe they should do the same. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. You can follow us on YouTube and on Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi over there. And of course, the website, sliceofscifi.com, where you can read up more about some of the movies we're covering, independent features, short films. I'm working on getting some more short films in the mix. Horror, sci-fi, action, thrillers. We're covering as much as possible here. And for the movies that we have done reviews for, you can leave your own review, your own impression of the movies that we are reviewing. Just come on over and click on how many stars you think the movie deserved. I want to thank everyone for your donations and your pledges. Your support means everything because it helps keep us online. The websites, the media, the shows, all of it. Your help is greatly appreciated. If you want to learn a little bit more about how you too can join in and help support the show, you can head on over to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/sliceofscifi. I have lots of books and DVDs here that I'm trying to figure out how to make them worthwhile as perks for the Patreon page. Haven't figured that out yet. I really don't know how to go about doing that, but again, if you have any suggestions, feel free to email me. I'd also like to send a shout out to my favorite geek rock band, Sci-Fried, for providing the theme music here. I think they've done a great job, and if you want to check out more music by them, you can check out their website, sci-fried.com. But that will do it for this episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.